Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Now, we have something special going on this week. It's actually my birthday tomorrow. And as a thank you just to this incredible community, we're giving a huge discount on Gen Health. So if you've ever been curious to check out a platform, you can start for a week free. But the fact that here I am being able to celebrate my birthday and knowing that we've already impacted thousands of people with their pain, whether it was years of low back pain, feeling like nothing would ever change, to suddenly being able to lift and feel confident in their body, or stubborn shoulder pain that now they're able to do things with their shoulder they wouldn't otherwise have thought possible, or knee pain, different surgeries, meniscus surgeries, and now they're hiking and running. And again, the impact that we've been able to make from the Gen Health platform that continues to change and adapt. I'm continuing to add more videos in, add more education, add to our plans and our phases. But the whole point of Gen Health is that you get the one platform you need to stop in any knee pain that you're having. We have plans that you can follow for just 5 to 15 minutes a day. Or if you're looking for full body plans that actually have the workouts, the mobility, the core, the muscle activations all integrated into one, we have that there as well. And I'm so dang proud of this platform. I'm so dang proud of this community that has made it what it is. Gen Health is here because of your feedback. Because of what you're saying that you're having issues with, or what's going on in your body, or how you need to receive and digest the information. These aren't just loops of videos. This is full education of me walking you through every single day, because I want you to know that there's a different experience that you can have within your body. And I'm so honored to be the one that gets to guide people through. And I hope that you get on board with Gen Health, see it evolve and change throughout the years, and give me the feedback I need so that I can continue to make it a better platform for you. So again, as a thank you, there's no special discount code needed or anything. You just head over to gen.health/free trial, try out a free week, get in at a discounted rate. And this rate locks you in year after year if you get in at this low price. So thank you again for being here. Thank you for tuning into the podcast. Thank you for trusting us within your body journey. We're so grateful. I am excited to welcome Dr. Rachel Zofness to the podcast. Now, she is a pain scientist, and this is something that we talk about a lot, obviously, on the Optimal Body Podcast. Coming from two doctors of physical therapy, we want you to understand pain in your body. And who better than to hear it from a thought leader revolutionizing the way we understand and treat pain? She's an assistant clinical professor at UCSF, lectures at Stanford, and consults on the development of pain management programs around the world. Dr. Zofness was trained at Brown Columbia, UCSD, Randy Children's Hospital, and Mount Sinai Hospital. Her new book, Tell Me Where It Hurts, drops March 2026 and will be translated into more than 25 languages. I'm really excited for you to tune in, start to understand pain in a different way, and hopefully have so many takeaways from this episode.
Rachel, thank you so much for being with us today. We absolutely love talking pain. We don't love how many people are out there in pain, especially chronic pain, because there's been this large percentage of the population that for so long hasn't felt like there's a solution for them. And you are doing such incredible work to help bring that to people.
I appreciate that. And my PT colleagues are among my most cherished. So I really appreciate what you guys are doing.
Which was so cool to be able to hear like who we're connected through with knowing PTs and stuff. So I absolutely love that. But chronic pain, it's a hard thing to really break into in terms of getting it across to people who are currently experiencing chronic pain. And it's just not an easy field to really, you know, to really be in, bottom line. Like Dom and I have talked about this several times, you know, with
a lot of our chronic pain patients, other PTs in the clinic would be like, oh, that's yours, not mine. Like, I'm not dealing with that. Like, people don't want to touch it.
You're
right. So what made you want to get into pain management and dive into pain science?
You're completely right. And like, rates of burnout for providers who treat chronic pain is extremely high, in part for that reason. And in part because most of us aren't taught about pain, which is something we'll probably talk about. I started studying pain, full disclosure, because I was scared of it. I mean, pain is aversive by definition, but I just find pain to be so scary. And I learned, I think I was a freshman at Brown, like a real nerd, and I was taking my first neuroscience class, and our professor was teaching us about pain. And specifically, he was explaining that pain was a biopsychosocial phenomenon, not a purely biomedical or anatomical one. And as soon as I started learning about pain, I realized I was suddenly less scared of it. And it really just took off for me. I went down the rabbit hole and I never stopped studying it. It's been like 30 something years.
And I think you bring up a good point. One, the burnout thing, it's real. I mean, I practiced in this outpatient hospital-based clinic where I thought I would be doing mostly orthopedic stuff. And I kept getting thrown the problem patients or the frequent flyers, which I think are such destructive terms to be calling these individuals who have chronic pain. And my schedule was filled up with 5, 6, 7 people a day who had, you know, chronic and persistent pain issues. And I would need to just duck into a room and do some breathwork exercises between each patient because I'm a couple months into being a PT and was already feeling the weight of that. So you bring up this point about how in school, and we learned this too, pain is a biopsychosocial model, biopsychosocial phenomenon. And then you get into practice and into the healthcare field, and it's lagging. It's not there almost at all, especially in those first entry points. Like, we aren't really addressing that at all. We treat it purely body part by body part. So like, why have we not started to put into practice in the healthcare system what everyone is being taught?
Right. I mean, that's so amazing. And everyone who has pain listening, which is literally everyone who's listening, because who doesn't have pain, knows that when you have pain, the first thing you do is you go to your doctor. And typically what happens is that you examine the body part that hurts. And then typically what follows from that is a recommendation for pills and procedures, or hopefully PT. I mean, that's sort of like the general sequence of things. But like you said, pain is a biopsychosocial phenomenon. And just to say what that word means, yes, of course there's bio components of pain, like tissue damage, system dysfunction, inflammation, like that matters a lot. Yeah. But what science says is that there's also psychological factors that matter. So like, our emotional health is tied to our physical health 100% of the time. Why? Because the parts of the brain that make emotions also make pain. Like, this is something that has been known for a really long time. Our limbic system, part of our brain's emotion machinery, is a fundamental part of our pain machinery. And then, of course, we have the sociological domain of pain, which is like everything else: socioeconomic status, access to care, race and ethnicity, history of trauma. Like, science says that, of course, the brain takes into account all available information when it's deciding whether or not to make pain and how much. But to your point, which is an extremely important one, 96% of medical schools in the United States have zero dedicated compulsory pain education. It's so crazy. Like, 96% of our med schools are not teaching doctors what pain is and how to treat it, which is so frustrating because, you know, our doctors go into the field so that they can help and heal, and we're not giving them the tools that they need or deserve in order to do that. So I think one of the most fundamental reasons we are trapped in this antiquated biomedical model is that we're just not educating people about pain, and therefore we're preventing people from adequately and accurately treating pain.
So what do you think should be happening when someone goes and they've been having this chronic pain, which we should define, right? That's typically over 3 months. Like, what are you defining chronic pain as? It's not an acute injury. It's not tissue damage. It's not like something just happened. So yeah. How long does it take for something to become chronic? And what should happen when someone goes in and the doctor says, oh, that's not acute, that's chronic pain, this is what you should do instead?
Right. So defining our terms, pain is so complicated and so scary. And I just feel like the more information we give people, like you said, the better off we'll be. So acute pain is pain that's 3 months or fewer. And that's like an acute injury can be, you know, you go for a run, you break your ankle. It can be an illness or, you know, an acute disease. It can be pain from childbirth. So acute pain is short term. It's expected to pass. Chronic pain is defined as pain that's 3 months or longer, or, and my favorite definition is pain that lasts beyond expected healing time. Like, what does that mean? Beyond expected healing time? Like, doesn't that depend on your age and like how healthy you are and your genetics? I mean, like, I don't know what that means, beyond expected healing time. So there's not really a great definition for chronic pain, but generally speaking, when we talk about chronic pain, it's pain that just isn't going away. It's lasted more than 3 months. You've tried the things and it persists. And we know that chronic pain actually has less to do with the body part that hurts and more to do with your pain system, your brain and your spinal cord misfiring. Like, the brain and nervous system are on high alert and they're giving you these danger messages when in fact your body's not actually in danger. Because that's what pain ultimately is. It's our body's danger system, our danger detection system. So we know with chronic pain that it's a disease of the nervous system and that our nervous system is on high alert and it's telling us that there's danger when there's not. Like, we've all seen those annoying car alarms. Like, you're looking out your window and there's a car alarm and the lights are flashing and the horn is blaring and like a cyclist has ridden by and you're like, bro, you're fine. No one's breaking in. You know, the windows are intact, you're okay, but the alarm is flashing anyway. That's sort of like the way I like to think about it, like a brain on pain.
That was a beautiful explanation, first of all, I have to say, of what chronic pain is, and a great way for people to start to understand it themselves. But, you know, when someone goes in and they say, okay, this is the pain that I've been having for a long time.
Yeah.
This is the normal treatment that they usually get. We already highlighted that. What do you think should be happening?
Totally. It's actually a more complicated question than, you know, I think we even give credit for. The real answer is, and I want to say this clearly, there is always a treatment for pain. Like, people with chronic pain are told, if you Google it, like, there's no treatment, there's no cure. That is a big fat lie embedded in this biomedical model that says pain is just to do with your body part. And if you've had all the surgeries and you've taken all the drugs and you're still not better, you are hopeless. And the world of chronic pain is ridden with hopelessness. And like, the reason I sat down and took 3 years to write a book, which I probably will never do again, is because I was just so tired of this narrative. It's false and it's a lie. So the way we want to treat chronic pain is by having patients put together what I'm going to call a pain recipe. And I want to say what that is. So just as there's a recipe for brownies, there is always a recipe for pain. And the recipe for pain is comprised, this will not surprise you, of biopsychosocial ingredients. So like we said, in the bio domain of pain, tissue damage, system dysfunction, but also diet, exercise, and sleep. Like, those are important ingredients when it comes to pain. So I want to conduct an assessment and ask about those ingredients. In the psych domain, we have your emotional health, your mental health, and I keep those separate because not everyone has mental health issues, but everybody has emotions, and I want to know how we're doing. Like, have you been stressed lately? We know that stress will hijack your pain alarm. Also in the psych domain, included in those ingredients are your thoughts and your predictions. Our brain is a prediction machine. If you are sitting around predicting that you will never get better, science says your pain alarm will be amplified. And then we said we have this sociological domain of pain. So I want to conduct an assessment about all the things in there. Like, are there environmental stressors that are hijacking your pain alarm? Do you have access to care? Do you have a history of trauma? Like, trauma and chronic pain are comorbid. They live together up to 80% of the time. That's not a coincidence. So just as there's a recipe for high pain, there's also a recipe for low pain. And the way we access that is by understanding all the ingredients that go into your recipe.
Now, Rachel, that's all good and well, but that sounds like a lot of work. How can we ever do that in the 8 minutes that we are with our doctor, go through all of that stuff? And I'm just poking fun at the reason that we haven't tried to implement a lot of this is the burden that it puts on the provider. And early in my career, I always wanted to blame the provider. Oh, you're just running them through the mill. But it is so hard to go against the systemic grain that is our healthcare system, which, you know, points out a lot of the problems that we have treating people who have chronic and persistent pain conditions. How can we tell and educate somebody who has persistent pain? Because so many people who've gone to somebody who says, who kind of tries to educate them, oh, it's a condition of the brain, it's a condition of the neurologic system, and they walk away feeling like they just told me it's all in my head. They told me that there's something wrong with my brain and that's why I have pain. How can we make it not a bad thing that this is an ingrained, neurologically learned thing that we need to start to address?
So, you know, I have been saying that pain is never something just to do with anatomy and physiology, but also pain is never just to do with emotions. Like, pain is never purely physical. It's also never just emotional. It's always both. Pain is physical and emotional 100% of the time. And you're right. A lot of people get this message, especially women and minorities, that the pain is all in their head, or, you know, it's just psychological, or it's a mental health problem. And I want to say clearly, that isn't true. That is not true. But what's cool to me about the actual science of pain is that if there are a lot of factors that go into making pain and amplifying it, that means there are a lot of factors that we have the power to change that go into reducing pain and turning down pain volume. So to me, it's a very hopeful message. And yeah, you're right. Like, do we want a quick fix? Of course, we are like a quick fix, hack this, hack that culture. And I would be the first person to recommend a pill or a quick fix if we had one. The quickest fix for treating pain is to look at the recipe of ingredients and figure out what for you is amplifying your pain. So for me, my high pain recipe, for example, is like sitting and staring at my screen for too many hours, not getting up and moving my body, getting a night of crap sleep, eating a crap diet, being really stressed out and like not setting boundaries around work. So I know that if those things combine to create a bad pain day, then I have a lot of agency to change those ingredients to create a low pain day. I know that I need to implement sleep hygiene. I know that I need to work on my nutrition. I know that I need to guard time to go outside and walk in the sun. And so there are a lot of things we can do. Like, you go to your doctor, you get your 8 minutes. You know, I'm not saying you shouldn't focus on your body. Your body's important too. We should be going to PT. We should be going to OT. We should be going to MDs. But when you've done those things, there's still so many things that you have the power to change.
And my issue too with people who are in chronic pain and continue to go to provider is that a lot of times we then start to hear so many mixed messages about our body. Oh, well, it's because T7 is rotated. Oh, it's actually because your hips are out of place. Oh, it's actually because, you know, and I hear this all the time, and it is so hard for me to continue to hear someone going to the next person and the next person and the next person. So how do we also not fall down that rabbit hole? Because it's like, I'm trying to get help. I'm trying to focus on all the components of what could, you know, contribute to my body. And I'm being told all these different things. Why does that make pain worse sometimes?
Right. No, you're totally right. And of course, it's natural to want answers. And we do want to know naturally, like, I have pain, what's wrong with my body? So, you know, when people come to me, I'm the last stop on the train usually, because I'm a pain psychologist and no one wants to see me, understandably. But I always want to know, have you had all the tests? Have you had all the scans? Like, I want to know. If you haven't had all the tests, then I'm going to send you for those. But, you know, I hear these stories in my office that people tell me about what their chronic pain has been blamed on. And there are so many stories of asymmetry and like your pain. So can I tell you a quick story? Yes, I'm obsessed with 100%. This story. Here's how this story goes. About 30 years ago, there was a little boy growing up in Jamaica, and he loved to run, and he was really fast. And he ran, and he ran, and he ran. But as he grew, something strange was happening to his spine. It was twisting into an S shape. And he was diagnosed with scoliosis, which is a very real disease where your spine twists into an S shape. It didn't deter him. He decided to keep running and keep training. He trained and he trained until he qualified for the Olympics. And by the time he qualified for the Olympics, his spine was so abnormal and his body was so asymmetrical that his right leg was half an inch shorter than his left. He didn't get treatment for the scoliosis. He didn't have surgery. That mofo won 8 Olympic gold medals. You know his name? I bet you do.
Yep.
Usain Bolt.
Usain 100%. Bolt. That mofo has very severe scoliosis. He is so asymmetrical that his legs hit the ground with like a completely different degree of force. And he reports that he has very little pain. Now, I am not saying that scoliosis can't cause pain, but if it was the only cause for pain, that man should be relegated to a hospital bed instead of like being the fastest man alive. So it's very clear that the narratives we have about pain are completely wrong and that pain is never something to do just with asymmetry. Like that just drives me crazy. Yeah. But so, yeah, of course, like you guys hear that all the time. I hear that all the time and our patients don't know better. So the antidote is understanding the science of pain. The antidote to all the BS messages is knowing fundamentally that neuroscience says pain is a biopsychosocial problem and it requires a biopsychosocial solution. That's the antidote.
I love that. And I love, as soon as you said, little boy in Jamaica
who loves to run. I know, I could see you. I could see that you knew.
Little boy in Jamaica who loves to run. I'm like, I know where she's going with this. And I love that story because it just shows, and there are so many people at the highest level who have so many anatomical, biological things wrong with them.
Right.
Who compete at the highest level and are the best in the world at what they do and have such low levels of pain that those testimonies and those anecdotes in itself should tell us that's not the whole picture.
And to your point, doctors and surgeons recognized that something was wrong. Like they recognized that when patients were coming to them for back pain, they would scan their backs, of course, you know, get a back scan. And they noticed that the degree of damage on the scans was not correlated with the amount of pain the person had. In fact, they decided to go around and scan the backs of healthy people without any pain. And it turns out that like 90% of us are walking around with slipped and bulging discs and all these other things that pain is commonly blamed on and absolutely no pain. Like, and that has been, there are doctors who specialize in every human body part, like shoulders and knees. And we know that that is true across the human body. We know that you can have abnormalities and no pain, and you can have no abnormalities and high pain. And that tells us very clearly that pain can't be due to damage and anatomy alone.
So you bring up another point, no abnormalities, because we hear this often, no abnormalities and high pain. What do we tell those people? Because they are the people, again, who've gone to many providers, have had every type of scan of every type of body part, and they're still like, I have no answer.
Right. Yeah. So you can tell I really like metaphors. I think they help make a complicated topic make more sense. So I love talking about the brain's pain dial. And this is the way I pitch it to people. Like if you imagine in your central nervous system, you have what I'm going to call a pain dial, and it operates much like the volume knob on your car stereo. So there are things that turn pain volume up, and there are many things that turn pain volume down. So among the things that adjust pain volume are stress and anxiety, our mood, like our emotional state, and attention or what we're focusing on. So here's how this works specifically. When stress and anxiety are high and our thoughts are anxious and worried and our bodies and our muscles are tense and tight, the brain sends a message to the pain dial amplifying pain volume. With emotions, our mood, we know that when our mood is miserable, we're depressed, we're angry, the limbic system will send a message to the pain dial amplifying pain volume. Same is true with attention. When we are thinking about pain, focusing on pain, talking about pain, the brain will send a message to the pain dial amplifying pain volume. But here's what's cool about the pain dial. We know that the opposite is also true. So when stress and anxiety are low, our muscles and our bodies are relaxed and our thoughts are calm, the brain sends a message to the pain dial lowering pain volume. And mood and emotions, we know that when our emotions are positive, we're happy, we're feeling joyful, we're engaged in pleasurable activities, brain will lower pain volume. And so too with attention. We know that when we're distracted, like you can be so absorbed in some activity that you briefly forget about your pain. That is not magic. That is just our brain's pain dial. So I like to just remind my patients that there are many, many factors that are changing pain in every given moment. So we talked about this as a recipe. So what I like to do is sit down with my patients and actually write out their high pain recipe. And like there's a whole section in the book to do that on purpose because not everyone can afford to come to my office. And I want to make sure that every single person has access to tools to change their own pain volume. So when you write out your high pain ingredients, like I said, for me, it's poor sleep, crap diet, high stress, sitting and staring at my screen, not moving my body. That leads me naturally to my low pain recipe. So mood is in there. Our emotional health is in there. Our stress and anxiety is in there. How much we're moving, how well we're sleeping. So I really just want to empower everyone to know that there are so many things they can do to change their pain.
I mean, it's so, when you were talking, it reminded me of someone who recently had reached out in my DMs, very angry because the halftime show, I enjoyed it. And they said, that is horrible music. It's horrible taste. And I was like, okay. I mean, but okay. Like that, your opinion doesn't do anything for me. I don't know why you need to argue with me. Like, that's fine. We could disagree. Well, your generation, like just kept going and kept going and kept going. I knew that they were in pain because there's no point to randomly argue with someone on the internet you don't know, who you don't know what they actually like, what they enjoy, like all of the things. There's no reason to continue to dig and dig. Like they just would not back down. And so I asked them about pain. Oh, I'm in pain every day. I can barely walk. And it's sad. And people are like, how did you not cut off that conversation? Why don't you just ignore them? Why don't you just block them? And I said, because as much as it's hard to have these conversations with people, it's not about me. It's not about, they're not attacking me. There's something in their own life that they're battling right now, and it's increasing their pain signals.
Yeah.
And if I can't talk to someone to say, okay, that's fine, we can disagree, but like, what can you do? Like, how can I help you? Yeah. How can we continue to open up this conversation?
Yeah.
Then how are people ever going to get helped? You know, and I think coming up with that pain understanding of like, what heightens my pain? How can someone who feels like, well, I move, I'm trying to do the things I have, you know, I've gone to the providers, I'm trying to eat healthy, I'm trying to do all these things. How can someone who feels like they're trying to create the recipe for themselves, but still in it?
I just need to give you kudos for that because it was such a cool like 180 seeing this person by the end of the conversation was like talking to you about your pain, saying, yeah, I get that we can have different preference in music. I just don't understand this generation's music. It was just like so cool. And that's the testament to sitting in it with somebody and hearing their story a bit and like being there. And like you have a lot of uncomfortable moments with patients who are in pain. Talking about what they've been through and it, just like sitting and being in that with them brings down that noise, turns down the volume.
Yeah, I know. It's actually funny because they had unfollowed me and then they refollowed me and said, actually, I'm back. Sorry that I reached out to you. I'm having this, and this happen. So like, what should I do?
Oh my God. That is a true testament to you as a provider. Like kudos to you, like for sitting in that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank wow. You. I probably would not have done that. I would have just blocked them. But I have such a low tolerance. I'm also a New Yorker, you know, I just like have such a low tolerance. I'm like, all right. But yeah, no, I think it's really important to acknowledge that pain is enraging. Pain is terrifying. It makes us feel helpless and hopeless and alone. And, you know, the longer we go on having pain and the less help we get, the more infuriated we become because we rely on our healthcare providers to guide us and give us help. And at a certain point, you've tried all the things, like you said, and you're still in pain and you just feel like it's a death sentence. Like this is just the rest of your life. And it is not a coincidence that suicidality is 50% higher in the chronic pain population. Like that's real. So, your compassion is important.
Thank you.
So I love the analogies that you've been bringing up, which, by the way, you are such a psychologist with all your analogies.
I know, I love it.
My therapist had an analogy for everything. He's just like, I'm just like, love that. But the recipe one, I've never heard it exactly put that way. And I really like it. And I really think it's empowering to people, because something we hear often is, well, I can't lower stress because finances. I can't change this because of this reason. I'm like, okay, there might be a few things in that recipe that are out of our control to some degree.
Right.
There are still 5, 6, 7 other components that we might be able to tool up a little bit. And I'm guessing, I don't know what possessed you to write this book, Tell Me Where It Hurts. We were talking about that a little beforehand, but I'm guessing, how was the book written so it can help people understand and approach this recipe of theirs without creating more for them to just think about?
I wrote the book because it pisses me off that most healthcare providers have never been trained in pain, and we all as providers deserve to understand it. I was pissed off that people living with pain, which is, you know, 1.9 billion people around the globe and 100 million in America, have never been told how pain works and have been sent down all these biomedical rabbit holes. And I also wrote the book because I have a firm and fundamental belief that pain science and treatment should be affordable and accessible to everyone. Like, I cannot think of a single person who doesn't deserve to understand pain. So that really was motivating me to put everything that I've learned over the past like 35 years into a book. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. There were parts of it that were really enjoyable and parts of it that were really challenging, but I carved the book into 3 parts. So the first part is like the bio domain of pain. We said it's biopsychosocial. So it just explains a lot about just the fundamentals, like how does pain work? What is the neuroscience of pain? And the language is extremely friendly and approachable. It is not intimidating. And I promise everyone listening, you can understand it. Part 2 goes into these other pillars of pain. Like, when I say psychological ingredients, what do I mean? And how does that work on a biological level? When I talk about social and sociological ingredients, like, what does that mean? And, you know, as you go along, you'll see how all these ingredients apply to you and your body, or at least that's my hope. And then part 3 is just straight up tools. Like, you are someone living with pain, or you're someone who treats pain, you're a healthcare provider, and you want to take these tools and either apply them to your patients or to your own body. So what are the tools in the bio domain of pain, the psych domain of pain, and the social domain of pain that you can use starting today for $0? Like, that was my goal. How do I put everything that you need to change pain volume, to change your pain recipe, into, you know, a book? So part 3 is practical evidence-based strategies.
That's absolutely amazing. And everyone needs to get their hands on this, because it is, as we age and we get wrinkles on the outside, our body is going to change and our tissues are going to, our biological system is going to change on the inside. And that does and can have an effect on how we feel. And so being able to have strategies to lower those signals and what we're feeling on a day-to-day basis so that we can continue to move long-term, I think is just so incredibly important. And something that, you know, I remember my older patients would always say, like, aging isn't for wussies. And like, you know, like it's hard. And I see my mom, she's 73 dealing with osteoarthritis, and you know, it's hard. Yeah. So in people who, you know, they're continuing to move, they're continuing to do things, but the pain is really just continuing to stay or increase. And they feel like, I've taken, you know, the recipe of what my pain needs, and I'm trying my hardest to continue to, you know, do what I need to for that. At what point do you tell someone, you know, okay, maybe we need to look a little bit more at the biological system and get a surgery, or maybe we need to look a little bit more at talking with a psychologist? So at what point do we go a little bit further into some of these other areas with professionals where we can get help?
I want to say that I think one of the challenges as a healthcare provider is that we are all told to stay in our lanes. And, you know, PTs are told that their job is just to look at the body, and psychologists are told that our job is like just to look at emotional health. And that creates a real conflict for us as healthcare providers who are treating pain, because pain is a whole person problem and it requires a whole person solution. So what are we supposed to do as healthcare providers? Like, you have someone come in as a PT and they disclose to you that they have a very severe, significant history of sexual trauma. And you suspect that because of with the information they've given you, that the trauma and flashbacks and PTSD are potentially contributing to their pain. And like, by the way, you're right, that is contributing to their pain. And I have had PTs say this to me. So like, what are you supposed to do? I feel like referring is our best friend. Like, I have in my, you know, in my office, like a list of healthcare providers across disciplines that I am constantly referring to and just getting on the phone for consultations. I want to consult. I consult all day long. Like, I want to be talking to my MD colleagues. I want to be talking to PTs and OTs. I get patients who are really hard. Like, you know, as you mentioned, you were, you know, when you first started out, you were getting a lot of hard patients. As a pain psychologist, I get the patients that just aren't getting better. Like, I am the last stop on the train. I am not kidding. So I have the patients who have seen 40 providers before they come to me. They have been in pain for like a decade, you know? So it's really my job to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. Like, I have been trained in pain neuroscience and human biology and pain psychology for a bazillion years, but I really think of myself as a pain detective. I'm like, okay, what are all the ingredients here that are contributing to this person's pain recipe? And how can I empower them to look at the different ingredients and start making changes? So I think it's really important for us all to be collaborating and having conversations in order to help our patients do that.
Yeah, 100%. I had mentioned to you beforehand that in my first couple months as a PT, I felt like I loved talking to psychologists because I felt like I needed to be an armchair psychologist for a lot of these people. And again, was being told by, when I was in clinical rotations, was being told by my clinical instructors or being told by my colleagues when I was in the clinic, like, you're letting them talk too long. You need to be doing things. You need to be billing. You need to get billable hours in. And I'm like, you know, I'm okay with them talking and billing neuro reeducation, whatever. I don't care. Like, someone can challenge my billing if they want. But the example that you just brought up, I specifically am thinking of a patient, history of sexual and abusive trauma, you know, didn't have family or friends close by, had seemingly everything working against them. And I'm sitting there as a young 20-something PT like, okay, why don't we lay down and try to do some breathing?
Yeah. And, oh, man.
But then the flip was, at the end of that session of breathwork, I was like a breathwork cult member too, because I have a lot of history of head trauma, both from playing football in college and a bad car accident where I had lots of post-concussive symptoms, and breath work and journaling, like, and cold training brought me through that. It resolved everything going on for me. And I was like, this is it. So I was doing breath work with all these people.
Good but, for you.
And I got them on their back and got them breathing. And 10 Good minutes later, you. They're in tears.
Good
they're
for
like,
you.
They're like, I don't feel anything in my back. And I'm just like, I don't know why I hadn't really dove into the physiology at that point, but it's like changing one ingredient. And that would be my message, because the other question I have for you was skepticism. You get these people
after. Say the message, changing just one ingredient. Say that. That's so important. Say the message.
Changing one ingredient can make you feel something different. And as soon, like, I get chills when I say that, because people are so skeptical. You get these people after 20, 15 years of being in pain, and they're like, okay, I'm going to breathe. And as soon as you make them feel something different, that is what can start to break down those walls of skepticism. Like, that was just changing one ingredient for 5 minutes. Imagine what will happen if we change five ingredients for the next 5 years.
You just nailed it. That's pain science. That's it. Because, you know, among the myths, like, I feel like we're just like exploding myths today, but among the myths is like, oh, certain things are just psychological and certain things are just biological. That is such horseshit. Like, of course your breath is physiological and it's emotional. Why? The brain and body are connected 100% of the time. So when you change your breathing and you reduce your stress and you reduce your cortisol and you change your neurotransmitters and you reduce muscle tension, what do you think happens to pain? You know, like, emotions, and thoughts are physiological. They trigger a biological cascade of events in the human body. So when we change just one ingredient, like we use a breathing strategy, we use a relaxation strategy, we try mindfulness, it is biological. It is physiological. It does change your body. And of course, it has the potential to change your pain. But there's so much stigma and misunderstanding around that, that people are wary of it. And it goes back to what you were saying before. A lot of our patients have been given this message that pain is all in their heads. And like, what is more stigmatizing and minimizing than suggesting to someone that their pain is just psychological, right? It never is. Of course, it's biological. But to your point, changing just one ingredient can absolutely change pain.
But you have to be willing to be open to it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Which is why the education piece is so important. Like as soon as you hear that breath work changes muscle tension, changes neurotransmitters, changes stress hormones, and lowers pain volume in the brain, maybe you're like, oh, well, if that's how that works, maybe I'm willing to try that. So to me, education is the core of all of this.
1,000%. I mean, and it's, and stories and the metaphors that you're using, like, I think all of that plays a role because like you kind of alluded to this entire podcast, pain can be empowering. And though we started by saying how scary it is, by understanding it better, like it can
be.
We
need to feel pain.
Yes, exactly. And I know you've talked about how important it is to feel pain.
Yes.
And without it, you know, how do we see that people can have all these structural issues and have no pain? Like that should be so empowering. If I can I get there? You know, can I be the 80-year-old who's still running? Can I be that person? If other people can do that, why can't I? Yeah. And I hope that people get that empowering message. One last question I had for you is how does someone turn, like say they had an accident or a trauma or an injury, and it is an acute issue that they're dealing with. How do they manage those pain symptoms in a way that it doesn't become chronic?
So we want to always take care of acute pain, right? Like we want to be doing all the things we need to do. With acute pain, what we typically need to do is rest, get help, take care of our body, like pay attention to the bones and body parts. Yes, of course. I don't think there's any one way to prevent it from becoming chronic pain, but I do think a really important piece of recovery from acute pain is to continue moving. Like we don't want people, and of course, everyone listening should follow their doctor's orders. Yeah. But like, it turns out that like being sedentary and stopping all movement is usually a recipe for chronic pain. I also want people to be thinking about their emotional health as they're recovering from acute pain. Like if you have a history of trauma, consider going for trauma treatment. Like I can't see anything bad happening from treating trauma. That seems like a good thing. It's a win-win no matter what. I want people paying attention to sleep. I want people paying attention to diet. I mean, there's no one quick way to prevent acute pain from becoming chronic because there's a recipe of ingredients that create chronic pain. But we know that being sedentary and not taking care of sleep, diet, exercise, emotional health is a recipe for chronic pain. So I would say just like paying attention to your emotional and social and physical health is the best way to go.
Oh yeah.
And just having this education interwoven throughout all providers. I mean, this is where we're fighting an uphill battle because like you said, all providers should be preaching this message. All providers should be educating people who have acute accidents, especially if it's something traumatic like a car accident that affects people emotionally. This should be part of the education to help, you know, lower the risk of it developing into something chronic. Yes. And to your point on, we shouldn't just sit and be sedentary and not do anything. When we look at old guidelines of how they used to handle certain injuries.
I know.
It's crazy to me, like especially back injuries, especially low back injuries, which is one of the highest burdens on the American healthcare system is treatments and costs due to low back pain. And just on our economy in general with missed days from work and all the statistics that go into that. Like it used to be low back injury, just rest it. Don't lift. Don't exert yourself.
No.
It's crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Yeah. And I should say, since you're talking about PCS or post-concussion syndrome, that it's one of my favorite things to treat. And I was working with the UCSF Headache Center for many years treating their PCS patients. And I just found it such a fascinating diagnosis that is so fraught, understandably, with fear and oftentimes like paralysis. Like, I'm having these symptoms. What does this mean about the rest of my life and my ability to function? It's your head. I mean, that's so scary. So, you know, one of the things that I found was so significantly important for working with those patients was talking about how resilient your brain really is. Like, our brain is plastic. Neuroplasticity is real, and our brain is constantly changing. And, you know, we know that if the brain can change, that means pain can change. And that message to me is such an important message. If the brain can change, pain can change. So, you know, I think the message is, yeah, like the messages we think and say to ourselves and say out loud and other people say to us are a really important part of recovery.
And I love, I need to hear you say that, because I played college football for 4 years. I was smashing my head for eight years. The car accident I had, I was having memory issues in my early 20s. And I still to this day have those fears of like, what's my brain health going to be like when I'm 60?
Yeah.
Am I going to be able to remember my name or remember, you know, so those fears totally exist, knowing what my brain has gone through and the symptoms that I've already had. So,
yeah, well, that makes sense. You would be a robot if you weren't worried about those things. Like, it is natural and normal. Like, when we have pain, pain is terrifying, especially when it's chronic pain and symptoms last. That is terrifying. And that's normal and natural. Like, I try and convince my patients, like, if you're experiencing anxiety and you have pain, that is effing normal. Like, that is what we call a normal response to an abnormal situation. The body is not built to be in pain day in and day out for years on end. So if you're experiencing stress or anxiety and you have pain, that's normal. The question is, what do we do with that, right? Like, if we go into paralysis mode or avoidance mode, where we're not moving our bodies, we're not doing the things, we're not getting in cars, you know, because that's part of the treatment. Part of the treatment, believe it or not, is getting back on the horse and doing the things. That's going to help stress and anxiety go down. Part of the treatment is understanding that if the brain can change, pain can change, and having some hope and having some, I don't want to call it optimism because I find that really hard with pain, but I guess just having some hope, and hope breeds motivation. So maybe you'll start doing the things again. Yeah.
I love that sentence. Now, for people who are like, okay, I'm ready to dive in, I need to understand this more, I need to create my own recipe and find my ingredients, where can people get your book, Tell Me Where It Hurts?
Yeah, so it's on Amazon and it's also on bookshop.org. And I have a dorky website where I've been collecting free resources for about, gosh, I don't know, 15 years. And it's just my last name, it's zafnis.com. So if people are curious about the book or podcasts, I'll put this one up there. Or if people are curious to read more scientific papers, like, there's just so much on there, like journal articles and great videos and book references for books or recommendations for books. So, yeah.
Perfect. We'll have all of that linked up.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. Again, we love talking about pain. We love talking with psychologists and people who talk about the mind, and we really appreciate the work you're doing and the tools that you gave us today. That's like one of my most selfish things about these podcasts is I feel like I get to learn so much from incredible professionals like you.
Yeah. It was like one of the coolest ways someone has explained chronic pain in the way that you did. So I think you're truly helping a lot of people.
Oh, that's so kind. I really appreciate that. And I really do think that collaboration is going to be the answer for treating chronic pain. Like, PTs and MDs and psychologists all in the room together. Yes. So I think we're on the right track.
Thanks for sticking around for another interview with Dr. Rachel. She had such incredible ways of thinking about pain and also that recipe to help get us out of chronic pain. Please consider passing this along to somebody you might know who's dealing with this. And remember, we have that massive sale for Jen's birthday on our Jen Health annual membership. If you want to come join a movement community to start following a plan, having that day-to-day accountability, check that out down in the show notes. And of course, we will see you on the next episode of the Optimal Body Podcast.